This week on COVID Race and Democracy.
Sanctions, you know, when they become extremely difficult and have a huge impact and damage when they run for extended periods.
The two-year Ethiopian civil war has come to an end, but harsh Western sanctions on Eritrea for its alleged role in the war remain in place.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. I finally realized for adjuncts what DEI meant. It meant discrimination, exclusion, and inequity. That's our DEI.
There are over 30,000 adjunct faculty at California's community colleges, and many are angry about their living conditions.
And the purpose of that walk is to generate more interest, awareness about the specific case of Leonard Peltier, who is the indigenous political prisoner. He's been in prison 46 years, so this extensive campaign to free him through executive clemency is underway.
And the 15-week walk to justice demanding freedom for Leonard Peltier is heading to Washington, D.C. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The Ethiopian army has decisively defeated the insurrectionist Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. Last week, in Pretoria, South Africa, representatives of the Ethiopian government and the TPLF signed an agreement formally ending the civil war and laying out a path forward. The U.S. State Department issued a statement commending the agreement, but Western media and pundits were largely negative and especially critical of Eritrea, whom they accused of helping Ethiopia win the war. CNN ran a story in which Norwegian scholar Kjetil Tronvall disparaged the peace deal and predicted its failure. At the top of the report, they recycled a 2021 video alleging Eritrean atrocities, which was substantiated only by Tigrayan allegations. Michael Rubin, a former Pentagon official and current fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, called on the U.S. to designate Eritrea a state sponsor of terrorism, which would trigger a new round of sanctions in addition to those the U.S. imposed on Eritrea in November 2021. The 2021 sanctions include exclusion from the SWIFT system for executing financial transactions and payments between banks worldwide. The four nations now excluded from the SWIFT system are Russia, Iran, North Korea, and Eritrea. Eritrea's economic and political institutions do not mirror those of Europe and North America, and the country is often called the Cuba of Africa. I spoke to Yamani Gebreyeb, advisor to Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki, about the current U.S. sanctions. We spoke by phone while he was on the sidelines of the U.N. General Assembly in New York City in September.
If you're going to trade and use U.S. dollars or euro, and much of the world trade is done in those two currencies, particularly the U.S. dollar. And those transactions have got to go through banks. And if you're using the U.S. currency, they go through U.S. banks. So they stop it. They cannot do the SWIFT thing, which Russia is also suffering from these days, which means they essentially block financial transactions involving trade of all sorts. But they also did other things. For instance, they closed the accounts of Eritrean diplomatic missions in a number of countries, which meant that our diplomatic missions became almost impossible for our diplomatic missions to function because they cannot pay rent, they cannot pay utility bills, other bills. So they disrupt the diplomatic work of Eritrea. That was one of the things that they did. They also had an impact in terms of Eritrean remittances, Eritreans in the diaspora sent to their families.
It also means that once major corporations, you know, institutions that we do business with get a feeling that Eritrea is under sanctions, they become very nervous about doing any business with Eritrea. And we had an experience with this also during the previous 9 year old sanctions on Eritrea. Then it was an arms embargo on Eritrea. But people don't get to read the fine print when there are sanctions resolutions. They just hear that Eritrea is under sanctions. So they don't want to deal with Eritrea. For instance, many times we had difficulties importing vaccines and medicine to Eritrea because the carriers feel that they're dealing with a sanctioned country, that they may run afoul of sanctions, and therefore they block the import of vaccines. For instance, at one time, UNICEF, the UN agency, had to charter a plane because the commercial carriers refused to carry goods to Eritrea. They were in short supply, you know, so there was a gap when we had run out of vaccines until this arrangement was made. Sanctions, you know, when they become extremely difficult and have a huge impact and damage when they run for extended periods. The last sanctions went on for almost 10 years under sanctions. So that had a major impact in terms of the economy, the living conditions of the population. Now, this time around, those sanctions were lifted in 2018 after the peace with Ethiopia. And they were reimposed recently on a unilateral basis by the United States. So what has happened is, you know, now it's it already has an impact, particularly in terms of financial transactions. But if they go on for an extended period of time, like the previous sanctions, then their impact will be that much greater.
That was Yemane Gebreyeb, advisor to Eritrean President Desaias Afwerki, speaking by phone during the UN General Assembly in September. Anne Fitzgerald, political science professor at Canada's Wilfrid Laurier University and director of the Paul Sully School of International Relations, said that Eritrea's role in the Ethiopian war has not been proven and that the West should learn to cooperate with nations like Eritrea whose institutions differ from their own. Why do you think the West is so hostile toward Eritrea?
I think that the cooperation that the West has received from numerous other African leaders has not been mirrored by Eritrea. Eritrea has its own system, it has its own policies, it has its own governance challenges and economic development challenges. I think that where the West is really missing a trick is in engaging with difficult partners or partners that they deem to be difficult. And, you know, it's like the situation in the country that I'm speaking from at the moment with a country like China. We've had our challenges in coping with our relationship with China, but there are things that we have to cooperate with China on in the future. And we have to find ways of working with not so much difficult partners, but partners whose systems, governance systems, political systems, economic models are not strictly aligned to ours. It's not in any country's remit to impose their models and ideologies on other countries. What we can do is work together in the spirit of healthy partnerships in the future. That requires engagement, that requires dialogue. And Eritrea sits at a very geostrategic corner of the world. It's got some terribly strategically located ports. It sits on some very important maritime corridors and straits. And it would make sense for everybody to cooperate and work together, irrespective of the different economic and political models that we have in place for the betterment of global supply chain resilience, economic resilience, and bilateral and multilateral cooperation in the future.
That was Canadian political science professor Anne Fitzgerald, whose expertise includes Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa.
Arha, 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 arha
This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. The Biden administration has said that it will support Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and his coalition in Brazil. Brazilian labor activist Fabio Bosco spoke to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer about the Brazilian election. Bosco is a member of the Brazilian Sindicato dos Metroviários, the Transport Workers Union, and of Conlutas, an independent labor federation.
There are some parallels that we can draw from the 1964 coup d'etat that was funded, sponsored by the US. But now what happened? The US imperialism, they are not supporting Bolsonaro. There is a difference. What happened in Brazil, the majority of the capitalists, the Brazilian capitalists, and also the international powers, all of them are interested at this moment in allowing Lula to become the new president. And why? Look, Lula has an international image as a kind of left-wing or trade union leader, but these facts belong to the past. Currently, Lula is building a national unity government with every political force he can bring together with him. That means primarily the bourgeois parties, you see? So he'll build a government in alliance with the capitalists to protect the capitalists' interests and also the international capitalist interests, you see, not only the national ones, but the international ones. So at this moment, President Biden called Lula yesterday and to congratulate him and say that we must collaborate in protecting the Amazon, in fighting back hunger, and also protecting the borders of the United States against immigration. That's what he said. So what's happening? Lula is becoming part of the international capitalist interests. So at this moment, that's the politics of imperialism. On the other side, this tactic of blocking roads, highways, and using truck drivers to do that, and I must tell you, reinforce this idea, there are 2 million truck drivers in Brazil. But the ones that are blocking, maybe they are 2,000, you see? So it's a small minority that are funded by the agribusiness, sectors that are connected to Bolsonaro. So it's not the truck drivers. It's a sector of truck drivers, small sectors funded by these guys. Yes, this is something traditional in Latin America because, look, when you block the highways, look, they blocked the international airport of São Paulo this morning. 25 flights were canceled. So it's a big problem for the functioning of society and the for the capitalists as well. So there are parallels that we can see clearly. But what we see that in Brazil, the generals, the army, are very much influenced by the politics that comes from Washington. So if Biden says Lula must rule, the army in general will say yes. But if Biden says, look, Lula is not the best one to do the job, then certainly it would be possible to organize the top generals to do some kind of action to prevent that, if they could not do it through democratic means, I mean, you see, through the Supreme Court or parliament or elections, I don't know. So I think these parallels we can see, and it's very important for us to be aware of that. Because look, today Washington is supporting Lula, but and putting pressure for this international agenda and to have this government of national unity. But just in case, the situation in Brazil, which is very bad, you see, Steve, the unemployment is still high. The jobs that were generated in the last period is low quality jobs. 33 million Brazilians do not have enough food. So the situation is very bad. And there might be some kind of uprising. In this case, if Lula cannot control that, certainly Washington and the Brazilian capitalists will resort for Bolsonaro. You see? That's the idea.
And this need for unity that Lula is talking about, the unity of the capitalists and the working class, was that the program of Cook, the Workers' Party, when he first ran? What's the difference between their program then and today, the program of Lula?
Look, the program is similar, but the political conditions when he was elected 20 years ago, they were different. Because look, in his first term, the economy was very positive because Brazil became the main exporter of some commodities. You see, coffee, sugar, orange juice, soybean, iron ore. So the Brazilian economy was positive at that moment, which allowed Lula to have at the same time the banking system, the big capitalists making a lot of money, and to provide we call here family allowance, which is a support for the very poor. You see, this support would be something like $50 per month to the very, very poor. So in his administration, he tried to connect these interests. You see, the big business will make a lot of money and the very poor will have some money. The working class that has labor rights, they were put under attack during his first administration. And the opposition to Lula was the liberal bourgeois parties that were opposition, but they voted the main reforms that Lula proposed. Now we have a different scenario, you see. The economic conditions are very different because the international economy is not going well. And the Brazilian economy, the predictions that next year it will grow only 0.5%. So you have less space to provide, you see, this support for the very poor. And probably he will have to carry out liberal reforms. And the opposition will be the far right. The far right has 20% of the parliament. So they will be the opposition. So it's an opposition that's more difficult to deal with. I have to tell you, Steve, that also for the working class, it will be a big challenge, you see, because look, the working class at the same time will have to fight back the far right and will have to fight back the liberal policies coming from this Lula-led national unit government. So it's two enemies that sometimes are in conflict. And so it makes things much more difficult. So I think that we'll have challenging times for everyone, for Lula to rule with the capitalists, to the far right to keep all the influence they have, and for the working class to keep their rights and improve their living conditions. When we talk about the challenges we have in Brazil, we see that on the one side, it's necessary to independently self-organize the working class. And on the other side, we must put our efforts in building international solidarity, because these two together are very powerful. Isolated, the Brazilian working class will have much more difficult to overcome all the challenges we have ahead. But international solidarity may help all these struggles to win. So when you suggest an international campaign to oppose the privatizations, I think it's a necessity for the working class across the world.
That was Fabio Basco of the Brazilian Transport Workers Union and the Independent Labor Federation, CONLUTAS, speaking with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. That was King Clav, Planet Drum Song, featuring Mickey Hart from Playing for Change Around the World. This is COVID Race and Democracy from Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. On Monday, October 24th, the United States Justice Department held a press conference to accuse China of breaking U.S. laws in its effort to challenge U.S. power on the world stage. We go to Black Power Talks from WBPU 96.3 FM, a Pacifica affiliate station in St. Petersburg, Florida, for more.
Uhuru, I'm Soliana Bakel.
And I'm Dr. Matsumela Oda. Uhuru means freedom in Swahili, and freedom is on our minds 24/7.
On Monday, October 24, 2022, the United States so-called Justice Department issued a media advisory that they would be holding an emergency press conference that afternoon regarding what they called a, quote, significant national security matter, in which U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland would discuss, quote, malign influence schemes and alleged criminal activity perpetrated by a nation-state actor in the United States.
At the press conference, Garland announced that their target was the People's Republic of China. The DOJ accused China of breaking U.S. laws in efforts to challenge U.S. power on the world stage. The Attorney General accused several Chinese nationals of spying on behalf of Beijing and seeking to disrupt a U.S. government investigation into the Chinese technology company Huawei. In New Jersey, the FBI charged two Chinese nationals with conspiring to act as illegal agents on behalf of China by using a, quote, purported academic center in that country to seek sensitive information from U.S. academic institutions, end quote, thus criminalizing working relationships between universities in the U.S. and China.
These indictments come on the heels of FBI raids targeting African and Puerto Rican organizers in the U.S. who are accused of acting as illegal foreign agents on behalf of Russia and of Cuba. On July 29, 2022, assault rifle-toting FBI agents raided seven offices and homes of leaders of the Uhuru movement in St. Louis, Missouri, and St. Petersburg, Florida, using flashbang grenades, drones, powered battering rams, and armored vehicles. They took phones, computers, hard drives, and financial records, claiming that the Uhuru movement was acting as a pawn of the Russian government by running candidates for local office on a reparations platform and by gathering signatures on a petition charging the U.S. government with genocide under international law.
From August 23rd to the 26th of 2022, FBI agents visited or called nearly 60 people across Puerto Rico who had joined or supported the July Juan Rios Rivera Solidarity Brigade to Cuba. Agents claimed to be investigating the breaking of an unnamed federal law or Cuban security infiltration. Two pro-Cuba activists in the U.S. were also contacted by the FBI asking about the Puerto Rican Brigade. Chairman Omalia Chitella of the African People's Socialist Party reflected on the October 24th press conference announcing the U.S. indictments against China.
It was an extraordinary press conference, especially given the kind of attention given to the press conference before it was held, notifying the media and anybody who would be paying attention to these kinds of alerts that this press conference was occurring. It promised to be a dramatic occurrence that would be revelatory in terms of what it would expose about attempts by a foreign government to interfere in the elections and the pristine democratic process of the United States government with its institutions and things like that. Instead, what it turned out to be was an instance of public self-aggrandizement by the intelligence organizations of this country, that is to say, the United States. And it clearly was a part of a process that has been developed to create a narrative and deepen a narrative that would threaten all the people in this country, in the United States in particular. Although we've seen this something that's extended to Africa and obviously to Puerto Rico, this notion that there are these powerful foreign governments that are involved in stealing the freedoms and resources of the decent, law-abiding, justice-loving people of the United States. That's the kind of narrative that has been created. But the thing is to be able to obscure the anti-democratic power of the United States and the colonialism by characterizing this war that they're making against colonized people, oppressed people who living in concentration camps, commonly referred to as Indian reservations and barrios and prisons and ghettos of the United States. They want to obscure the fact that there is no democracy for us. And they would characterize what they're doing to us as a fight to save democracy, to protect democracy. So the war that's being made against the colonizers is being put forth in that fashion. And similarly, what has been recognized by some historians for a long period of time is that imperialists have defined critical need for imperial power to control Africa, to control Europe, and to control South America. And right now, the United States government is involved in an existential crisis. Part of this crisis is domestic, and everybody's experiencing, and there are two sectors, contending forces inside the United States domestically who are fighting either to preserve their power or to achieve power. And that was something that was made manifest sharply on January 6th when mobs of white people attacked the electoral process in this country by invading the Capitol, actually defecating on the floors of the Capitol, chasing the vice president of the United States through the hall, threatening and calling vocally, verbally calling to hang him. This is one expression of it. Sectors of the white people who are afraid of what they characterize as Trump and is bigger than Trump. I would remind people that 57% of the white people in the last two presidential elections voted for Trump. So it's not Trump. If there is something that's happening in this country, there's colonial consciousness that exists within the colonized population, a recognition, if not at the top of their cognition, that everything that that they enjoy comes as a consequence of taking it from colonized and oppressed peoples around the world. So you've got all of these people in a state of hysteria. And then you've got the raising up the specter of the Russians and the Chinese. And of course, in this instance where the United States is engaged in war against Russia, using Ukraine as the vessel for that, where they pumped in billions of dollars to carry out that war, and where there's an ongoing ideological and political barrage that's being directed at everybody in the world who will listen to it against Russia, and then China being such a force as well. Both of these are forces in the international arena who are contending with the power of a decrepit, dying world order. And that's what we're looking at. And then, of course, there's Africa that's central to much of what it is we're looking at. China contesting U.S. influence and Western Europe and influence in Africa. Russia in Africa now, that makes it necessary for the first time in the 246-year history of the Marine Corps that they would make an African, a four-star general, and put him over the Africa Command, which has the responsibility of securing and maintaining control of Africa by the United States, protecting Africa from Africans inside of Africa, from Africans generally, and also protecting the interests of the colonizers from China and Russia. That's part of what we're looking at. That's part of what is raising these contradictions and China becoming such an extraordinary economic force that challenges the United States and Africa, that challenges the United States and Asia, that has even intruded in a very serious way into the economic arena of the United States and the rest of Europe, represent a fundamental and existential crisis. And then the United States, this great beacon of democratic rights as it puts itself forth, cannot come out and say, we can't compete with China. We can't compete on a level playing field with China. Therefore, we're going to criminalize all the economic activity that China's involved in, stuff that we do, that is to say the United States on a regular basis in any country in the world that it wants to, we're criminalizing it. We're criminalizing the activity of Russia. We're criminalizing the activity of Black people who are fighting against oppression. And this is, they've thrown this together and they've put this, this press conference was a part of a whole strategic narrative that has been created to justify attacks on oppressed and colonized people in the name of protecting the American, in quotes, public from powerful foreign influences of Russia and China, who were continuously, constantly demonized virtually every time you open up your laptop or go to a TV or something to that effect. That's what you're going to see from these honest so-called pundits coming from the United States.
That was Chairman Amalia Shetela of the African People's Socialist Party.
That was Amalia Shetela, Chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, responding to the current wave of aggression by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation targeting anti-colonial struggles. We thank Black Power Talks from WBPU 96.3 FM in St. Petersburg, Florida.
We want to talk about it. Colonize mine. Upload the revolution principle. You see a rock on the shore and say it's always been there. Download, no responsibility. Do what you want, nobody cares. Upload the master race idea. Genetically disposed to rule the world. Download a future full of isolated, full of isolated boys and girls. Upload a two-party system. The lesser of two dangers, illusion of choice. Download a veiled form of fascism. Nothing really ever changed. You never had a voice.
That was Prince with Colonized Mind. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. There are over 30,000 adjunct faculty at California's community colleges, and many are angry about their living conditions. Some are called freeway flyers since they run from one college to another to teach. Last month, East Los Angeles Community College faculty member Khalid Hussein was removed from his position on the executive board of the American Federation of Teachers 1521 in Los Angeles after fighting for better treatment of adjuncts. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
After 21 years of teaching, I just kept my head down, made sure I had a day job to pay my bills. Teaching was a passion for me. I loved teaching, but I was never allowed to do it full time. I was a finalist once, didn't get the job. And then after I applied again at my college, I was not even given an interview. So something happens when you are an adjunct for a long time. There's kind of a stench that you develop. It's called an adjunct stench. And sometimes they won't even give you an interview. But anyway, in 2016, I started becoming an activist for OER, Open Education Resources. Free textbooks, basically. So in 2016, I still attended my department meetings, and I brought that OER issue to my department meeting and introduced it. My department, my colleague, a political science full-time tenured professor, is also the president of the Academic Senate. And so I gave it to him, and I introduced it to everybody else, but I could not even get the time of the day from this Academic Senate president or any full-time professors. The adjunct professors asked me, oh, can you give me the link? I would like to check it out. It's a free textbook. It was actually a good textbook. So to make a long story short, after relentless activism, pushing, reminding, cajoling, pestering, the OER finally was, I was given the permission to use it. officially, you don't need permission. An adjunct professor or a full-time professor, they can pick their own textbook. But here I was told, no, you need to let the senior faculty decide if it's appropriate, and then you should not just go by yourself. Once I started using it, I got the go-ahead from the faculty, the tenured faculty. I received an email from OER. It's called OpenStax. They wanted to verify that I'm indeed a professor. So they wanted me to provide them the link to my department webpage where I'm listed as an adjunct or as a professor. And so I have never had a chance to look for that. So I went ahead and looked. I was not listed anywhere. Yeah. And so I contacted my vice chair and I said, you know, I need to provide this link to prove that I'm a professor. I don't see my name in the website. What's up? I don't see anybody, any other adjunct faculty name on the website. There are 18 faculty members in our department. Only 5 are full-time and the 13 are adjuncts. Most of the classes are taught by adjuncts. Majority of the classes are taught by adjuncts. And most of the students are educated in poli-sci by adjuncts. So his reply to me was, we don't have to list adjunct faculty on our website. That's what got my attention, finally. That woke me up. I'm like, what? We're teaching most of the classes. Yeah. This makes no sense. And then college lately started to push a campaign of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. So I stated to my vice chair that in the name of diversity, equity, and inclusion, I can see your picture is on the website, your teaching philosophy is on the website, your bio is on the website, your areas of interest are listed on the website. All the students can see those before they sign up for your classes. Most of the classes are taught by the majority of the adjuncts in the department, in the discipline. Why aren't they listed? Why we are talking about DEI and there's no DEI for adjuncts? Mm-hmm. I struggled with this for more than a year and a half. And I finally realized for adjuncts what DEI meant. It meant discrimination, exclusion, and inequity. That's our DEI. And so I was so upset that I finally ran for office. Again, the irony of this is I was written in again as a write-in candidate for delegate to the union's executive board. I'm like, where is this coming from? Is it the district doing it to us? As a political science professor, you have to take all these things into account. So I was putting my expertise into my own situation. And then I realized the district is only following what the union negotiated for us. And our district is controlled by our union. Majority of our board of trustees, the members of the board of trustees, are bankrolled, handpicked, and elected by our union. Any administrator who is disliked by the union cannot stay in their job for too long. The board of trustees, all it needs, a call from the union president, and they would remove that administrators. And a lot of people don't know this because I was an administrator. I know this. You should read an administrator's contract and look at the California Education Code for the rights of administrators. They have none. They're at-will employee. They can be fired without cause, without any recourse. It's written in their contracts. So when I became the delegate on the executive board, which is the highest decision-making body in the union, the only higher body for decision-making is the membership itself. I started asking these questions at the executive board meeting. And that got a backlash. I realized that I could only find one other delegate who was an adjunct on the executive board. There are more than, I believe, 35 or 40 people on the executive board. One of the very first meetings I attended, I noticed on the agenda, there was a short item that said, give more time to chapter presidents to serve and help their members, which sounded very good to me. And my chapter president from East Los Angeles College made a motion to move that agenda item up for discussion. I asked the question if there was any fiscal impact to that motion. And there was silence. And all of a sudden, there was a low voice. It was the treasurer, newly elected treasurer, who said it was going to cost the union more than $400,000. And I fell off my chair. This is what's going on. My union is in the business of wealth transfer. Take the wealth created by the work of the adjuncts and give it to the full-time tenured faculty in forms of salary and benefits. That's the wealth transfer that's taking place. Make no mistake. That's exactly what's happening right now. The adjuncts are paid a fraction of wages for the same exact work. We teach the same exact class that the full-time faculty teach, yet we get a fraction of the wage. Plus, why that is? Because my union negotiated a contract where there are only four or five steps of increments for adjuncts, but there are more than 20. We get no benefits. You were talking about at the beginning of this program, Steve, you were talking about the adjuncts work for very little pay and benefits. And I was thinking, what benefits? We get no benefits. The district started offering. The union made a gigantic fuss and deal over forcing the union to offer adjuncts health benefits. Do you know how it is? It is based on pro rata of how many classes you're teaching of a full-time percentage. If you're teaching 2 3-unit classes, then you're at 0.4. If you're teaching 3 3-unit classes, then you're at a 0.6. So if you're at a 0.6, and I was teaching 0.6 at one point until they took it away from me, another story. But even at 0.6, I would have to pay the remainder 40% of the premiums. So I tried to sign up for it. And when I was signing up for it, it turned out I could not afford the premium just for myself. And when I tried to include my wife and son, it comes to thousands of dollars a month. Well, basically, I was a whistleblower with just three emails that I sent out. I revealed what the union was doing and how it was. The union itself acknowledges that 69% of its members are adjuncts, 69%, and 31% are full-time. And the emails that I sent out, it revealed scandalous details of the inequities we're suffering. And it was not well liked.
This letter from the lawyer and the union president to you, did you feel that? It sounds like coercion, that they're actually threatening you to leave your union position without any kind of trial, without any kind of process for these accusations that you want to form a competing union.
So, Steve, I received that letter on a Friday afternoon. Then that same Sunday, I receive an email from the president. Friday afternoon, I get the letter from the lawyer and the president. Then with less than 48 hours later, Sunday night, I get an email from the president saying, I am suspending you until you reply to our letter or pending action by the executive board. And then on Monday, less than 24 hours later, I get an email from the same president saying, I have been suspended by the executive board. I will not be allowed to attend executive board meetings at the local or at the campus level. So those three things speak for themselves. Judge, jury, and executioner. No evidence, no trial, no opportunity to present my side. I am excluded. And they asked me to resign. Am I going to resign? Forget it. Never. I have no intention of resigning.
That was Khalid Hussein of the American Federation of Teachers, 1521, speaking with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. We'll be right back. That was Hard Work by John Handy. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. The Grand Convening Council of the American Indian Movement has organized a 15-week national walk to demand the release of political prisoner Leonard Peltier. The Walk to Justice, Free Leonard Peltier, is traveling from Minnesota through Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, ending in Washington, D.C. on November 14th. Lenny Foster of AIM spoke to KPFK's Michael Novick about the Walk to Justice.
Well, the walk that was organized by the American Indian Movement AIM Governing Council out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, is being spearheaded by Rachel Thunder, one of the organizers, Lisa Ballinger, and Frank Paro, and they're all with the American Indian Movement. They made plans to do a walk from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and end in Washington, D.C. on and around November 14th. And the purpose of that walk is to generate more interest, awareness about the specific case of Leonard Peltier, who is the indigenous political prisoner, foremost renowned American Indian Movement leader and warrior, who was accused of being in a firefight on June 25th, 1975, where two FBI agents were shot, killed, and Bob Robidoux and Dino Butler and Leonard Peltier were accused as the leaders of that group that defended the Jumping Bull compound. And he left the area, escaped, and then the government, federal marshal, FBI, mounted an intense manhunt, which led into Canada, where they captured Leonard Peltier, and through violations of the Constitution, they broke every law in that apprehension, fabricated false affidavit witnesses, and coerced witnesses. He was tried before a judge that was very prejudiced, and they found him guilty and sentenced him to two life sentences. And he's been incarcerated since 1977. Initially, he was sent to Marion, United States Penitentiary, Marion, Illinois. Then he was sent to United States Federal Penitentiary, Long Park, California. And he was informed that they were going to assassinate him. So he made an attempt to escape, which he did. And he was apprehended after a couple of days, and then he was sent. After capture, they sent him to United States Federal Penitentiary, Leavenworth, Kansas. And that's where I became acquainted with him. I started visiting him as his spiritual leader in March 1985. So for the next 20 years, I visited him every quarter, every 3 months, and conducted a Swelot ceremony. It's an ancient cleansing and purification ceremonial practice of the North American Indians. So we did that with him and also other Native prisoners at that facility. Like I said, I visited him for the next 20 years and did the Swelot ceremony. We smoked, prayed with the pipe. So he was a very engaging participant in these ceremonial ways of our people, and that sustained his humanity, sustained his sanity. You know, the United States federal penitentiaries are very dangerous places. Like I said, they made one attempt to assassinate him in Lompoc, California, at the United States Federal Penitentiary. So he's always been cautious about his surroundings and who he's involved. And he's been locked down for 46 years. So it's been a long time. And I've been visiting him since 1985, which is about 37 years. And I feel like I've been in prison myself visiting him. And it took me through a long process with him. So we're at a point now where He has a committee, Leonard Peltier International Support Committee, which is headed by a group, and also by Gene Roach, a survivor of that firefight at Jumping Bull in 1976. Carol Golke is another strong supporter. So he has a few people who have remained loyal and stuck with him, including myself. So it's been one of the most intensive cases in the United States relations with the American Indians and the United States government. As you are aware, United States government has signed over 300-500 treaties with the Indian nations and broke every one of them. So they are not sincere or respectful players in this scenario with the treaty making. So we always have to be aware of the relations between the United States government and the Indian nations. He's been in prison 46 years. So this extensive campaign to free him through executive clemency is underway. It's ongoing. We've had numerous walks. The most recent one is ongoing right now at this time. AIM Governing Council from Minneapolis, Minnesota is spearheading that walk and hoping to meet with officials in Washington, D.C., with the Federal Bureau of Prisons, the Civil Rights Division, and the Joe Biden administration, and seeking his support to provide executive clemency and release Leonard Peltier and allow him to go home.
Lenny, could you say something about the physical challenges that Leonard Peltier is facing in terms of his health?
Well, he's had a heart operation. He has an aorta aneurysm. He has a very severe diabetic case. He's got high blood pressure. He's failing eyesight. So he's not in good health. And being confined in the area is not good for him.
And that was American Indian Movement leader Lenny Foster speaking to KPFK's Michael Novick. For more information on the walk, follow the Walk to Justice Free Leonard Peltier Facebook page. Rallies and events will be hosted along the walk, and it will convene in Washington, D.C. on November 14th. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.